All right, I want to be sure it's working. Yes, it's recording this time. All right. We didn't, in spite of plugging it in last time, the second half of the lecture didn't get recorded. So we lost it to history. Okay, so how do we get the actual emergence of classes out of this story? So here's basically the way I think the reasoning goes. So what we're doing here is we're tackling this first transition. Remember, if Cohen is right, we have four stages in history, three transitions between the first and second, between the second and third, and between the third and fourth. Two of these transitions have happened historically. A third is predicted. The claim of a theory of history is that we can give the same kind of explanation under the same theoretical argument for the first two transitions. If that's right, it adds credibility to the claim that the same kind of explanation will hold for the projected third transition. How does it work for the first transition? So here's the way this story would go. The analysis goes. In the absence of an exploiting class, the forces of production would eventually reach a point where they would permanently stagnate or at least develop in even slower ways because there'd be no motivation. People would have, in effect, through the increase of productivity, restored the Garden of Eden. They would be working relatively little. They would have relatively low risk. That is, the forces of production would guarantee them an ability to store food sufficiently that they're in a low-risk environment. Producers would simply opt for less work rather than more production. And they would become relatively indifferent to subsequent improvements of the force of production. Not indifferent, so there might still be slow development of force of production, but slower than would occur if there were exploiting classes. If an exploiting class emerges, however, the stimulus for improvements would increase again for two reasons. The exploiters would have an interest in improvements in productivity. Since this increases the surplus they have available to them and thus their power. Because with surplus, exploiters can hire professional warriors. You can have a warrior class that doesn't produce and an increasingly stable and well-funded and secure warrior class if the surplus goes up. So that creates incentives for exploiting classes to keep improving their capacity to extract surplus. And secondly, the condition of scarcity is perpetuated for direct producers because their condition of scarcity is recreated by virtue of surplus being extracted from them. And so they have some incentives to improve productivity as well because of their deprivations generated by the very fact of exploitation. Again, this only shows that if classes emerge, they would further the development. Now, why should we expect classes to actually emerge given that? From this point, the analysis becomes, I think, storytelling rather than scientific demonstration. That is, this is an argument for why we might expect this to happen, but because we can't actually observe it, we can't gather direct data, although you can gather indirect data in some circumstances, it remains a fairly speculative argument. For long stretches of human history, before classes emerged, there was already sufficient productivity for classes to emerge, but they didn't. But as a contingent event from time to time in any given community, someone, some families, just because of the random distribution of motives and energies and insights and abilities, and selfishness, just as a distribution, not as the mode. It can be that extreme selfishness and not wanting to contribute to the reciprocity only occurs in 5% of the population. And eventually, in some 5% of the population, it occurs in people who are also really capable of taking advantage of circumstances, of local circumstances. So one way of thinking about this is that through contingent processes, randomly, From time to time, people try to take advantage of the existing surplus in order to subordinate others. And mostly, they don't succeed. That is, mostly when there's a threat of that sort, people will resist the threat successfully. But occasionally, if rarely, the threat succeeds. Now, what are the circumstances in which it could succeed? So there's many ways you can imagine this happening. One plausible story for which I think there is some historical evidence is that hunting and gathering societies lived alongside settled agrarian societies, so that you have settled agrarian societies in fluvial plains without class differentiation. They were just hunting and gathering societies who gradually produced more of their own agriculture rather than gathered all of their agriculture. Along with that came the domestication of animals as another form of transformation of the hunting side of hunting and gathering into a domesticated side. Nomadic herders of domesticated animals lived alongside, often in the periphery of the more agrarian side of this mixed, diverse ecology of communities. And it's possible that the ways in which the initial subordination of people to which made possible the appropriation of surplus occurs is from herding communities to subordinate agricultural communities and essentially become the overlords of and to create, to impose a class structure on a subordinated population. Or it could occur through a random process in which internally differentiation occurs. So all that you have to have for the story to work is that through some kind of process, unspecified, this is black box, but it just has to happen sometimes, the effort to subordinate part of the population to do the work and to appropriate the surplus, that occurs, that a coercive apparatus is created and is funded by the extraction process of the surplus, and that once created, it is stabilized. So essentially, the stabilization of this new order occurs through coercion, and through the ability to mobilize coercion for purposes of extracting surplus and stabilizing the social relations within which that extraction can take place. Why does this become self-perpetuating? Well, I think there's two reasons for this. First, with respect to potential conflicts with surrounding communities, all things being equal, a society with an exploiting class is likely to be militarily superior to a classless communitarian society. You know, all things being equal, over a long enough period of time with enough instances, if you have two communities which have a periodic interaction and one of them has a specialized warrior class that's funded by the extraction of surplus from an exploited class, they will be militarily superior to neighbors who remain communitarian because of the coercive advantages of having specialized military functions. A division of labor over military is more likely under conditions of exploitation where part of the surplus can be used for that purposes. So the first point is that when you have the emergence of classes, you also have the emergence of coercive capacity, which is likely to be more effective because of the security of the funding of that specialized activity. And this means that when conflict occurs between these kinds of communities, the militarized one with a warrior class is likely to prevail on average. So that's one reason why once you get a class structure within a pre-capitalist communitarian world, it will be able to dominate surrounding more communal societies. And secondly, the ruling class in such society is able to adopt a wide range of strategies which make it more difficult, once it's stabilized, for exploited classes to overthrow its power, both through repression and through co-optation. Ruling classes who control the surplus are in a strong position to repress and disorganize opposition. Now, here's then the key idea. Mostly such attempts fail. You know, so the early attempts to create these kinds of new inegalitarian orders, they'll often fail, perhaps most often fail, but they don't have to succeed always to become stable once they do succeed. And once they do succeed, this will have the consequence of more rapidly expanding the productive capacity and thus creating the upward spiral of consolidation, so that you emerge from agrarian communities with weakly differentiated classes and proto-states to agrarian civilizations with strong states and extensive military capacity. And then what happens is that those states begin to create class structures, primarily through the enslavement of neighboring populations. So I think the dominant view about how in Egypt and Mesopotamia and other places slave labor was organized was that it was organized through the subordination of surrounding communities through the use of military force. In the long run, because such processes of conflict within and between societies, there will be a tendency for exploitative class relations to persist when they would in fact facilitate the expansion of the forces of production. When they do that, then that increases their survival and expansive capacity. When they don't do that, when you get a purely consumption-oriented exploiting class that doesn't deploy its capacities to strengthen its ability to extract surplus, but just to live in a particular way, when it doesn't develop the forces of production, it will not increase its capacity in its conflicts with neighboring and other societies. So in the long run, it is those forms of exploitative relations that develop the forces of production that then enable a full consolidation of those regimes, of those forms of society, and their expansion and their duplication. This is a kind of implicit quasi-Darwinian process. So the survival of the fittest idea, that's the slogan version of Darwin's view about species, when applied to societies, is the survival of societies in competition and conflict with other communities and societies around them. And that survival is enhanced when the forms of extraction of surplus that emerge when possible also strengthen the development of the forces of production. This explanation for the initial emergence of classes is a specific example of a more general functional argument, namely that the social relations are what they are because they facilitate the development of the forces of production. In the extreme version, it's they are what they are because they are optimal for the development of the forces of production. They're the best possible relations. You don't need that argument that they're the best possible. You just need the argument that they're a significant improvement over the alternatives, that the social relations of production are what they are because they better facilitate the development of the force of production than the relations which they replaced. In this case, they replace the relations of a more communitarian society with a weaker division of labor and the inability to mobilize resources for specialized military purposes. And again, just to reinforce this point, the trick here is that the social relations of early class structures that emerge not only take advantage of the existence of a potential surplus, But in so taking advantage, they both create an enhanced military capacity and they unleash further development of the forces of production. So they're not stagnant once they create this new division of labor. That doesn't produce stasis. What it produces is a more dynamic form relative to the rival societies around it. And that's what then consolidates this into a new kind of social order. Yeah?
So it's not... So he's arguing that it's not inevitable that class societies emerge, but that once through random whatever they do emerge, then people's subjectivities are such that they will, perpetuate that because they are the fittest ones and understand that the continued development of the forces of production continue to enforce their power.
Cohen is not making strong claims about the motivations of the actors who control these modes of these higher capacities. It's that as long as you have a situation in which there is an increased robustness and durability of a system by virtue of the fact that its forces of production are now developing more rapidly, that system will become more stable by virtue of that, less prone to disruption, either by exogenous forces from other societies or internal disruption. Then that's what's doing the work. It's increased stability and capacity for reproduction is what's doing the work of maintaining the existing, the new class relations and deepening them. You don't have to imply that the actors who are benefiting from this are unusually selfish or unusually motivated in particular ways. It may be that the system is further stabilized when you develop ideologies of a warrior class, for example, or of privileged elites that see themselves as representatives of divine figures. You know, there's all sorts of other elements in the elaboration of the superstructures of these class relations which will further stabilize and strengthen them because of the way in which they mobilize the motivations of actors. But those are additional arguments. Those would have to do with the relationship between how the economic structure gets stabilized by various superstructural elements. Yeah.
But can't we expect that that there will be interests that will defend relations of production that don't necessarily develop the forces?
Right, but can they? There will be, and the question is, can they succeed in perpetually protecting the existing relations of production that are in the face of rivals that more adequately develop the forces of production? So I think the argument here, did you understand this point? So the question is, you have a communal society that doesn't have classes, in which the actors do not particularly care about the development of the forces of production. They're not motivated by that. They have adequate mode of production. They have adequate forces of production to produce the kind of lives which they like to live. If some new innovation comes along that makes things easier, they're likely to adopt it, but there's no drive, no motivation for it. But they've already have the potential to produce a surplus, which they're not actually producing. Okay, so we're at this stage where there's this latent potential that's not being taken advantage of by anyone. Now, the actors in that community may overwhelmingly just like it that way and not want to change it at all. The question is, can they defend that social order over a long period of time in the face of X, Y, and Z? Now let's fill in the X's and the Y's and the Z's. One X is in some neighboring community or society with similar environment and similar productive, they have, for whatever accidental reasons, moved in the opposite direction. They have developed this division of labor around military force by taking advantage of the potential for surplus. Well, if that's the case, then it may become increasingly difficult for the more communitarian society to maintain its own relations. And therefore, they may feel the need initially to create a division of labor for self-protection reasons, not for purposes of exploitation, but just for purposes of maintaining a higher division of labor around military force. But then they let the genie out of the box, and they've kind of invoked the proto-class relations, which then consolidate into class relations. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to adapt to that. So there was a question of how kind of the first class society emerged in the first place, right? Kind of before there were surroundings. And there was a story kind of by Margaret Harris and Ben Simonson, also kind of post-Marxist scholars, that in the early stages of culture, there was kind of ability to produce more surplus, and most of the people were not willing to do that. But eventually, inside, they emerged kind of people who wanted to do that, and they kind of motivated their fellows kind of to produce more, and eventually would throw a feast. So it was kind of complete redistribution. So people worked somewhat more to kind of eat more at the end. So they didn't leave anything for themselves, but they were kind of had more prestige. And at some point of time, this complete redistribution transformed into partial redistribution, so that kind of they left something for themselves. And at some point, this became not kind of merit-based, but hereditary. So this is how kind of complete redistribution transformed into partial redistribution. And they kind of controlled like huge kind of warehouses of grains, which you said this is for community, but they would control them and kind of leave them for themselves and create their civil power. So this is the story.
Right. So the point is, there's lots of stories we can tell. We can, and these are just so stories. There's indirect evidence, there's some hints in various kinds of records, but it's basically asking, is there a plausible account by which, out of a community of reciprocity and shared and sharing and communitarian forms of both production and distribution, could there emerge differentiation? And there's a variety of ways you can imagine this happening. We know it did happen. So this is a case where we know what happens eventually. So these are attempts at reconstructing the kinds of process by which this could have occurred. And in a way, it doesn't matter. So long as it is the case that once it occurs, such societies then have a big advantage over others. And what matters for the Marxian account is that a significant part of that advantage comes from the way in which the new structures further develop the forces of production. That's a key part. I mean, if they have advantages over other societies for reasons other than that, and they don't further develop the forces of production, then it isn't this account. It's a different kind of argument. And there are other arguments. There are arguments about the development of history being strictly because of militarism, that it's all the development of the military forces of production. That's all the action is there, and everything else is just an unintended byproduct and has nothing to do with what drives historical development forward. So there the story is, our romantic view of hunting-gathering societies as these sort of peaceful communitarian communities is just not right. They were constantly fighting with each other. They were snatching resources of whatever sort they could. There was constant conflict in these societies, so that what triggered an ability to more effectively engage in that conflict was the development of military technologies, which then also enabled successful militarized hunting and gathering, slightly militarized, more warrior-oriented hunting and gathering societies to start poaching on the agrarian societies. And then they realized they could not just poach on them, they could actually subordinate them. And so that the formation of classes occurs as a byproduct of military competition. Well, there's an interface between the forces and production, forces and relations to production story of the more Marxian version and this military competition version. They do connect, but their driving dynamic is different in them. Yeah?
I think you just answered it. I was just thinking that, can you just be a better warrior class? There's a possibility for being more productive, and if you're more productive, you can go more time.
Right. So if you think that the process which anchors this system and renders it a coherent class structure, which stabilizes it as a social order, is when the warrior dynamics consolidates as a productive forces development dynamic, then this can be folded into one variant of the forces and relations of production story. There are theorists, though, who attempt to keep it disengaged from that and to have the whole story be the monopolization of the means of violence and the development of the means of violence, so that it's all the innovations that really matter for pushing history forward are innovations in warfare. The development of the stirrup, you know, in horse riding is a classic example. You know, it's a pretty small technical change which has momentous consequences for the ability of nomadic military forces of Central Asia to create the world's largest empires. Is the invention of the stirrup, some people claim. You know. I don't know if the difference between bareback riding. It's apparently because of the way you can maneuver military forces when you have stirrups. Your ability to gain purchase with weapons while you're riding horses is enormously increased with stirrups compared to the previous way people rode horses. Okay. So this is the story of the first transition, the emergence of classes. It happens through some kind of black box process, either endogenously within a community or because of conflicts between communities. It only consolidates itself as a stable class structure when it intersects a latent surplus producing possibility. Because to establish a stable class structure, you have to be able to produce a surplus to feed the dominant exploiting class. So once that's consolidated, then the key is that triggers a much more rapid and deepening development of the forces of production. So that those, and that's really what stabilizes the amount of surplus available then for ruling class purposes increases. It increases their ability to create a priestly class that also is paid for out of the surplus, which then provides for the ideological part of the ideological superstructure which defends the social order. And these agrarian civilizations which emerge out of these pre-class societies become very stable and last for thousands of years. So this is a super stable social order. Continues for a very long period of time. A military conflict becomes an organic aspect of these kinds of societies, whether they take the form of tributary societies or feudal societies. A military class is a central feature of these class systems. And military defense and competition between such societies becomes a central part of their dynamic of development. In this perspective, there's no difference between the Roman Empire and feudal Europe and the Egyptian Empire or whatever in China. These are all of a piece. They're all pre-capitalist class societies. They develop in their particular ways because of the particular challenges of the forces and relations of production. It's not the case that these all create continuously optimal relations of production for the development of the forces of production. But they do constitute improvements over non-class relations of production, so that all of these societies are able to develop forces of production more effectively than purely communal forms of production relations. One more element is needed if you're going to have a determinate overall trajectory of historical epics. So the Cohen version of historical materialism still has very well demarcated, if very broad, historical epics. If it were the case that there was an indeterminate variety of new social relations that could follow in the wake of the destruction of old relations, then the argument would not yield a well-defined historical trajectory. You need something to explain why you get the relations you get. Now, Cohen opts for, I think, a too strong version of this solution to this problem. He wants to say the relations of production you get are the best suited for the subsequent development of the forces of production. And best suited means they're the optimal one. So he endorses the optimality thesis. I don't think you need the optimality thesis in order to still have a coherent argument for why there's a trajectory. This is similar to, in evolutionary biology. You don't have to make the claim that every improvement in a species is the best possible improvement it could have had. It just has to be an improvement relative to the previous relations. That's all you need in order to explain why you get the development in biology from one form to another. It's just that it's an improvement relative to the previous with respect to the natural selection process. So similarly, I don't think you need to really have the optimality argument. You only need the optimality argument if you want to have a much finer grain set of predictions about what comes after each stage. So if you really wanted to distinguish among all the pre-capitalist class relations, and you wanted to make the claim that the form of pre-capitalist class relations that occur in every single place on Earth when that transition occurred was a specific type, then you would want to say it's the best possible. Having a claim about the best possible alternative would give you theoretical grounds for explaining why that form and not another occurred where it did. I think that's an unnecessary additional burden you're placing on the theory. Okay, let me summarize this broad account. Now, remember, historical materialism has really two different theories. It has this general theory of history, which is an attempt at giving a grand account of all transitions subsumed under the same kind of argument. And then it has a specific theory of capitalist history. As I said, the guts of the argument, the reason why it matters, is the specific theory of capitalist history. That's why we do all this. You, in a way, therefore, don't even need this grand theory of history if you could establish the theory of capitalist history, because that's what we care about. We care about overcoming capitalism, not overcoming feudalism. This is a theory about how, Marxism is a theory about how, in a world of capitalist exploitation and domination, there is hope and possibility of its transformation. A theory of the future of the history of a history of the future of capitalism would be a big help in understanding how do we organize our struggles now in order to increase the likelihood of successful transformation. If the theory of capitalist history is part of a general overarching theory of history, that could strengthen our ability to understand the fate of capitalism. If it's not part of some overarching thing, we could still have a theory of the fate of capitalism and the conditions of its transformation. It just wouldn't be buttressed by that larger framework. Okay, so the larger framework then, I think, contains five basic theses. These five theses together combine two kinds of explanatory moments. There's an argument about the more or less continuous development, sometimes fast, sometimes slow, of the forces of production. So our knowledge of how to transform nature continuously develops with different rhythms in different situations. And that's combined with an account of the radically discontinuous developments of the relations of production and their corresponding superstructures. That's the form of this theory. It's a continuous development of one variable and the discontinuous development of another, where the connection between these two has the character of hitting historical moments where there's increasing tension and incompatibility between them, and that creates the openings for qualitative change in the relations, which allows the continuous development of the forces to continue. Overall, in Cohen's argument, then, there are five theses which summarize this whole architecture of reasoning. And these I've explained in the article. I think I assigned my piece on from Reconstructing Historical Materialism with Andy Levine and Elliot Sober on how to distill Cohen's argument. These five theses that I use are not taken directly from Cohen. These are my way of breaking down his argument into specific pieces. So first, there's the compatibility thesis. Given a particular level of the development of forces of production, only certain relations of production are possible. So this is a simple point. You cannot randomly combine any relation of production with any given force of production. When you have a basic agrarian technology with the levels of productive development of ancient Egypt, you cannot combine that with capitalist relations of production. Capitalist relations of production are not possible under those conditions. That's the simple compatibility argument. Given particular forms of relations and also given particular forms of relations of production, only certain levels of forces of production are possible. So possible means that only certain combinations would be stable. If an attempt is made to restore slavery under advanced technologies, it would be unstable and develop crises. If in the United States today there was an attempt to make the labor force the property of capitalist owners, you know, so that it would be slaves who would work in Google. You know, so that the employees of Google, instead of having rollerblades to wander where they want and recreational facilities, were all the property of the owners of Google. Google would collapse. And not collapse simply because the particular people would rebel. You know, so even if you imagine that you could change their consciousness so that they would individually recognize that this was their only way of living, that they would starve if they rebelled, so that they don't rebel, it would still collapse because you could not have the kind of flexible cognitive responsibility and initiative required to use the forces of production of modern technologies. The demands on the human psyche to be an effective subject in that with those technologies would not be compatible with people being owned by others. That's the claim, of the compatibility claim. More poignantly, I think, the compatibility argument says the attempt to build socialism under the most unfavorable conditions, that is, huge deficits in technological capacity, the attempt to build socialism under those unfavorable forces of production will also generate crises, which will lead to a change in the relations of production. So that you cannot simply arbitrarily combine everything. If you attempt to build a democratic egalitarian society under very weak forces of production, the level of productivity needed to sustain that kind of structure of social relations, the compatibility thesis would say, would lead to crisis. You need to have high productivity in order to have democratic socialism, is the argument that Cohen would make. Now, we might challenge that argument. If you challenge the argument, you're basically saying that the relations of production have much greater autonomy from the forces of production. It's much more open to human will. It suggests a much more voluntaristic theory of the possibility of constructing alternative societies, that they are not heavily constrained by the nature of the productivity that you have. Well, that's definitely a rejection of the classical historical materialist position, which says that the nature of the social relations that you can have depends upon the nature of the productivity you have, and that's captured in this compatibility thesis. The second thesis is the development thesis. I've already explained that. The forces of production tend to develop over time throughout history. The contradiction thesis then says, given the compatibility thesis, that only certain relations are compatible with given forces, and given the development thesis, that the forces continuously tend to develop, for any given form of relations of production, there will at some point come a point in which the forces of production become fettered by the relations. The contradiction thesis says fettering is at some unspecified time scale inevitable. So long as it is the case that certain relations of production are only compatible with a certain level of the forces of production. Eventually, the forces of production continue to develop, and a set of relations are only compatible with a limited range of forces of production, not with all possible forces of production. Eventually, you get a fettering. Further development of the force of production are not possible so long as you maintain those relations of production. At that point, in principle, you could have permanent stagnation. That's one possibility. You could have regression, forces of production deteriorate. Or thirdly, you can change the relations of production. Those are the three logical possibilities. So if you believe the contradiction thesis, that is that eventually you get fettering, the forces of production are constrained by the existing relations of production, that constraint will eventually occur, then you eventually hit this choice point, and this is an epochal choice point. It may drag on for hundreds of years. It's not an event, it's a process of impending permanent stagnation, regression of the forces of production, or a transformation of the relations. The transformation thesis states that in the long run, when there is this fettering, when that occurs, in the long run, the tendency will be for the relations of production to be transformed. That's, in the long run, what's going to happen. It's a prediction. That permanent fettering will not occur. That's one of the predictions which I think is most vulnerable to criticism. In the next lecture, when I go through the criticisms of classical historical materialism, the transformation thesis that when the relations fetter the forces, in the long run there will be a systematic tendency for the relations to be transformed to unfetter the forces. That claim, which is equivalent to the claim that permanent stagnation is not possible, that's one of the vulnerabilities of this theory. It may be that in pre-class societies, in the original, more communitarian ones, permanent stagnation was not plausible because of the multiplicity of those societies and the relative ease with which these coercive divisions of labor could emerge and the simplicity of the transformative task which that implied. Whereas it may not be the case with highly developed forces and relations of production that permanent stagnation isn't possible. But again, that's what we'll explore. But still, in Cohen's argument, the transformation thesis is crucial. Permanent fettering of the forces of production, the prediction is not possible. And then for Cohen's account, I would call the optimality thesis states that when the relations of production are transformed, new relations will be created which are optimal, in Cohen's view, given the existing level of the forces of production for further development of the forces of production. Cohen's view is that they're optimal. That can be softened to simply that they are improvements. that the relations of reproduction which replace the fettering relations, they simply have to be unfettering. They don't have to be the best possible unfettering. They just have to unfetter the relations of production. If they unfetter the relations of production, that's sufficient to stabilize these new relations of production. Okay. That's the basic reconstruction of the general theory of history. On Tuesday, December 2nd, 3rd, 3rd, we will look at the criticisms of this classical theory.